Actu SF, les podcasts.
Bonjour, merci à tous d'être venus avec nous en ce midi, d'avoir décalé votre heure de repas. On a une rencontre avec Steven Erikson. Alors Steven Erikson, vous avez sans doute lu les premiers tomes du livre des Malaséens, des Glorieux Défunts, qui est en train d'être retraduit chez Léa. Mais Steven Erikson est canadien. Vous êtes né le 7 octobre 1959 à Toronto, exactement. Vous vivez au Canada après avoir vécu en Angleterre. On a une heure avec Steven, on va peut-être commencer peut-être par son environnement, un peu ses débuts, son environnement familial, comment est-ce qu'il est devenu écrivain. Il ne l'a pas été tout de suite. On parlera ensuite de son œuvre et puis on parlera notamment des bouquins qui ne sont pas traduits et qu'on ne connaît pas. Si vous avez besoin, si vous n'êtes pas anglophone comme moi, il y a des petits boîtiers juste derrière pour que vous puissiez avoir la traduction en appuyant sur un ou sur deux. Génial.
Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Voilà. Hop. N'hésitez pas, puisqu'on a la chance d'avoir donc des traducteurs qui traduisent en simultané tout ça. Steven Erikson, vous avez fait des études d'archéologie et d'anthropologie. Vous m'arrêtez si je dis des bêtises. Votre premier roman est arrivé quasiment aux alentours de 40 ans, ou pas loin, quand vous aviez 40 ans.
Voilà. Is this working? Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Actually, no. When did I do my first one? I was writing contemporary fiction. And so my first book, which nobody will ever be able to find, I think there were about 3,000 copies printed in Canada, is a collection of short stories based around my experiences as an archaeologist in Central America in 1983. And then I started I was in the master's program in archaeology when I dropped out and went to study creative writing at the University of Victoria. And from there, I went on to the University of Iowa, the Writers' Workshop. And I was writing also a coming-of-age novel called This River Awakens. So those were kind of my first books. And then I did a three-day novel contest in Canada where I was co-winner. So writing a novel in 3 days, I don't recommend it.
Ça, c'est c'est un peu le début, mais juste avant, dans quel contexte familial avez-vous grandi? Vous lisiez beaucoup, il y avait beaucoup de livres chez vous. Comment est-ce que vous êtes devenu lecteur et ensuite écrivain?
Well, we grew up very poor. My parents came across from Sweden to Canada and pretty much struggled for most of their lives. And so I grew up basically in poverty, but both my parents were big readers, especially my mother, which is one of the reasons why in choosing a pseudonym, I chose Erikson, which was my mother's maiden name. So I was kind of honoring the memory of my mother in that. So yeah, we grew up very poor, but what it did was we were in Winnipeg at the time, and we used to head out every weekend out into the countryside, basically to fish. And so we would fish all summer, every weekend, fill up the freezer with fish, and that gave us meals for the rest of the winter. But it was pretty rough.
Et quand est-ce que vous avez commencé à écrire vos propres histoires? C'est venu très tôt ou c'est venu plus sur le tard?
No, yeah, I thought I was going to be an archaeologist. But I had a dream to become an illustrator, a comic book illustrator. And this is in the days before computers. And what I found was to even produce one panel with writing, pen and ink, and then coloring would take me 2-3 weeks. And if you make a mistake, you have to start all over again. So I just sort of gave up on the visual side of things and stayed with the narrative. I think I wrote my first short story when I was in university for a local contest and came second. I don't think I've ever won any contest. I always come second or I'm tied for first. So that's kind of how it started.
On vous connaît plutôt pour la fantasy et la science-fiction, en tout cas surtout la fantasy. Vos premiers romans, vous l'avez dit, on va y revenir, c'est plutôt de la littérature générale, mais vos premières nouvelles que vous avez commencé à écrire, quelle a été la place un peu de l'imaginaire ?
Well, I think a writer who's beginning at a fairly young age, we don't have much life experience, so we have to steal it, and we steal it from what we read, and so you run the imagination that way, and you apply your imagination to modifying the things that you've read so that they fit your voice and they fit your style, and they're not too plagiaristic, so.
Quels étaient un peu les auteurs marquants comme ça de votre adolescence ou de votre vie de jeune homme?
I grew up reading Edgar Rice Burroughs, which are kind of romantic fantasy fiction. From there, I went on to the sword and sorcery writers like Robert E. Howard, Carl Edward Wagner, Fritz Leiber, such writers like that. So I guess short fiction was sort of my origins. And I did not follow the Tolkien stream into epic fantasy. I was very much coming from the sword and sorcery side of things. But I think the one that was the most evocative and inspiring was Stephen R. Donaldson's Lord Foulsbane and the Thomas Covenant trilogy. Because to me, when I look back on it, that was the series that pulled epic fantasy into adulthood, because it was very much books primarily with an adult audience in mind. And Tolkien, you can cross that sort of adolescent or even prepubescent threshold and take that into adulthood. But Lord Foulsbane was very much a statement of this is a book and a series and a character for a much older reader. And so that was my primary inspiration. Also, he forced me to the dictionary because his language, very Latinate language, and it was great to actually read. And it did influence my writing.
Votre premier roman n'arrive pas tout de suite. Il arrive quasiment à l'âge de 40 ans, si je ne dis pas de bêtises. Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé entre-temps ? Vous avez eu un premier métier, vous continuez à écrire régulièrement. Quel est le... Comment ça se passe?
I would work archaeology in the summers, so I'd be out in the bush, and I would not write a word while I was out there. I was simply being an excavator or surveying and immersing myself in the job. And then when the summer finished and I came around to university, that's when I would start writing. But at the same time, myself and one other person, Ian C.S. Lamont, we met on a dig. We're both archaeologists. And he introduced me to role-playing games, D&D primarily. And so once we started playing the role-playing games, even sort of not without even knowing it, we were building the Malazan world. And it took many years of gaming to sort of lay the foundations of that world. And then we moved into writing feature film scripts, and we thought, okay, maybe we can pitch this stuff as high epic fantasy for the film. We got no takers on that one, so we were sort of left out in the dark. And I guess at some point we both decided that we would write novels set in that world, and we split the history, split the settings, and I wrote Gardens of the Moon, and then I sent it to U.S. publishers. And everybody turned it down. They said there were too many characters, it was too complicated a story. The irony is, 3 years, well, after I had already done 3 books in the UK, we finally got a US deal with Tor. And to this day, I earn more out of the States than I earn anywhere else. So for any of you writers out there, if an editor rejects your work and sends it back basically saying this is too complicated, the readers won't take it, don't necessarily believe them. Just keep trying. Find your right editor. It took me a long time. We had to move to the UK for me to find my publisher.
Là, on commence la genèse du livre des Malazéens. Aujourd'hui, c'est donc une saga qui a une grosse quinzaine d'années maintenant. Qu'est-ce qui reste un petit peu du jeu de rôle initial et des premières fondations? Votre ami, c'était Ian Cameron Esselmont, c'est ça?
Yeah, he's writing Origins of the Empire now. He's just finished the first trilogy, and that is those are novels that are actually based on our games. A lot of what I wrote for the 10-book series is actually after the games in terms of the timeline. So the gaming provided the historical foundations and introduced a lot of the characters, but then each of us took the story forward from there. So are there many writers out here, beginning writers? I highly recommend role-playing games because it's a great experience in humbling you as a narrator because you have no control over your characters. And that's really quite an interesting lesson to learn as a writer, that sometimes your characters are going to take your story in directions you don't anticipate. And you need to roll with that. You need to go with it. So role-playing games are a great foundation for any kind of writing.
Si on reste sur le jeu de rôle, parfois, à contrario, on critique le fait d'avoir un univers trop posé, trop vaste. Par rapport à l'histoire, comment est-ce que vous vous débrouillez justement avec ça?
You're saying the Malazan universe is too vast?
Yes. Ouais.
Well, we have. I mean, the thing is, we could be writing through three more lifetimes and still not complete all the things we gamed. It's kind of sad to admit, but I mean, we would game for 4 or 5 hours a day, and we were both at university at the same time, sharing a flat. And we just went through the chips and the bottles of Coke like you would not believe. So we gamed a lot. And there were sessions that were... It was curious gaming, because you think of gaming where you've got a DM and 5 or 6 players. We were gaming one-on-one, and we were alternating who was running the campaigns and the characters. And there were sessions that would last 4 or 5 hours that were nothing but conversation. Which is kind of strange. Nobody pulled a sword, nobody cast a spell, nobody went anywhere. They just had conversations. And that really nailed down the characteristics of our players, of the NPCs and the characters that we were playing. In terms of conveying the immensity of the Malazan world, there are many literary cheats that you could do that evoke connotation rather than denotation. So you create the atmosphere by choosing your details very carefully, and the reader fills in the gaps, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Est-ce que votre métier d'archéologue, à un moment, influence votre écriture? Est-ce qu'il y a des liens entre guillemets, ou est-ce que ce sont deux choses vraiment séparées pour vous?
Oh no, both of us were archaeologists, and in North America. If you get a degree and you're specializing in archaeology, your degree is actually in anthropology. So you get a lot of cultural anthropology, you get linguistics, you get human evolution. All of these subjects are part of the degree. My two minors were ancient history and classics. So I had a fair grounding in terms of world building. But of course, the whole thing about anthropology is it's a study of human cultures in contact with each other, and what is created when two cultures or cultures make contact and then transition occurs. So the Malazan story, as such, is basically a story of civilizations and cultures in contact, and it's the history that we're writing.
Est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire un petit mot sur le système de magie que vous avez mis en place, notamment dans le premier tome et dans ce cycle-là, souvent il interpelle un petit peu les lecteurs. Comment est-ce que vous l'avez imaginé, créé, mis en place?
We created it differently than most fantasy magic systems I've seen and read, where magic is basically fully explicable. It has a structure, and that structure basically is another, it's kind of a replacement for a technology. We wanted magic to remain mysterious. So in terms of people writing to me, fans writing to me and to Cam, Ian Esselmont, the most prominent question is, how does your magic system work? And our answer is, we're not telling you. right? Because we want that mystery, we want that sense of wonder. Magic comes out of folklore and mythology in terms of storytelling as a metaphor for the unknown. And so to me, it seems contradictory to then explain the unknown because you've taken the magic out of magic.
Elle a plus de force cachée, quelque part. En tout cas, inexpliquée.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and a part of it was trying to fit our idea of magic into... By that time, we'd left D&D, and we were playing GURPS, which is Steve Jackson's generic universal role-playing system, which is a very freewheeling system. And it has a pretty good magic system as well. So we were trying to sort of shoehorn our ideas into that system. So we had to modify the GURPS magic system a fair bit. But if you want to find the kernels of consistency in the Malazan magic, you'd have to look for GURPS magic system.
Il y a 10 volumes aujourd'hui. Mm-hmm. Peut-être, est-ce que vous aviez imaginé que ce serait aussi vaste dès le départ?
Oh, I knew. The thing was, when we were first pitching it, when I found my agent in the UK, and we were first pitching it, we pitched it as a trilogy because we did not want to scare away the publishers, especially with the first novel, because if you come in with the first novel and you say, I'm planning 9 more, editors are going to balk at that. They're going to think, well, okay, we know he's produced one. It may have taken him 5 years. You know, how long is it going to take for the rest of the 9 books? So we pitched it as a trilogy, and then as soon as the book started taking off, Gardens of the Moon, I sort of let loose the truth and said, I've got 9 books planned after this one, and I've got the scenes, the final scenes of the entire series in my head, and they haunted me through the writing of that. People may take note that it took me 11 years to write the 10 volumes. The total word count is about 3 million plus, I think, for those novels. And I was basically racing against time to get to those final scenes, but having to keep myself self-contained enough so that I didn't rush anything. So it was a lot of writing, but it was frenzied.
Et, dites-moi, vous l'avez dit un petit peu fou, je crois que c'est 1 million d'exemplaires vendus, si je ne dis pas de bêtises. Une histoire qui continue.
Parce que là, I think we're a bit more than that now, but yeah.
Un peu plus d'un million.
Yeah.
Pardon.
It's okay.
Une aventure qui continue encore aujourd'hui avec des retraductions, par exemple en France. Vous avez fait d'autres cycles, d'autres romans. Quel regard vous avez sur ce cycle des Malazéens?
What's my opinion on it? With the 10 books, when I finished, I remember I was living in Falmouth in Cornwall, and I write in a cafe. I don't write in an office or in the house. I always take my work out, and I write in a bar or I write in a cafe. And I remember I was in a Costa, and I finished, and I looked out the window, and it struck me that I could walk outside, get run over by a bus, and everything would be fine because I'd done what I set out to do. And it was a very, very strange feeling. And over the next few weeks, it was as if this burden was lifting from my shoulders that I didn't even know I had on my shoulders. And that was a pretty extraordinary experience because I guess the series really had been haunting me for that long. And to get it done, was really quite extraordinary. And I almost didn't get it done because between books 9 and 10, I went to work on a dig in Mongolia, and that very nearly killed me. I got very sick. We were in northern Mongolia with a Russian crew, and the Mongolian crew that were with us were all from the city, so they didn't really have camping experience and living out in the wilds. They were pitching every tent underneath a tree that had been lightning struck. And I was just trying to say, stop doing this. and then they butchered a goat the first day, cut the head off the goat. They threw the head of the goat beside the fire pit, and then they quartered the rest of the goat, and we ate the goat using this big pot with vegetables thrown in, about a quarter water, chunks of meat, and rocks from the fire. Rocks that had been heated up in the fire were thrown into this pot. The lid was shut down. So yes, it was very tender, but the meat tasted like rocks. Anyways, the head sat beside the fire for 3 days before it showed up in the soup of the breakfast on the fourth day. And I got very, very sick. And it occurred to me that if I die between the writing of book 9 and 10, especially since book 9 finished with the only cliffhanger in the entire series, wherever my grave was in the world, people would annually come to it to pee on it, right? Because to actually not finish off that series would have been horrendous. So I was very sick, and then I got a spider bite that pretty much dropped me. And I realized that Mongolia was trying to kill me. So I backed out and escaped Mongolia. Having said that, it's a beautiful country, so I do recommend that. But avoid joining a crew that doesn't know what it's doing.
Entre les différents tomes, il y a parfois des grandes distances temporelles, il y a tout un monde. Comment est-ce que vous travaillez? Il y a beaucoup de docs, il y a des plans, des post-it, des échelles. Comment est-ce que vous vous y retrouvez pour créer vos histoires?
There are. The problem is we're hopeless at actually following our own timelines. So we make mistakes all over the place. And Ian Esselman's better at it than I am. So I have dropped some real horrendous timeline errors into my series. But at the same time, you know, I read and have read secondary histories. And they're not particularly accurate. So in that sense, I don't really have an issue with timeline problems. One of the classic examples is Egyptology, which has a series of rulers that are actually doubled up in order to make the timeline fit. So that's in the profession of archaeology. So in literature and in fiction, if we're creating a fictional history, I don't mind inconsistencies in the history. That's how I justify it anyways.
Vous l'avez dit, vous avez été un petit peu hanté par ce cycle des Malaséens, mais vous avez écrit de la fantasy après. Comment est-ce que, du coup, même si vous avez le sentiment plus léger, mais comment est-ce qu'en se replongeant dans un autre univers, on se débarrasse un petit peu de ces 10 romans et de ces 11 années d'écriture?
Well, what I did for the trilogy that followed was I went back 200,000 years in time, and where the Malazan series kind of sprawls, and its primary inspiration is the Iliad, and it really does sprawl as a story. So multiple settings and points of view. I wanted to go the opposite way and go inward for the second trilogy. And so in preparation, I downloaded the entire collected works of Shakespeare and read that through from start to finish to sort of pick up a different kind of cadence in the language. And so then I wrote Forge of Darkness and Fall of Light. I was ready to start Walk in Shadow, the third and final book, when I think it was either my agent or one of my editors dropped the bombshell that the books had not done very well. And that kind of took the wind out of my sails. And I knew I needed to sort of have a lot of energy to finish off that trilogy. So I've switched. I've also signed to do 3 more books in the Malazan world, taking place about 10 years after the 10-book series. And that's what I'm working on now.
Je lisais dans une interview que une de vos forces en tant qu'écrivain, c'était de faire de l'inattendu, d'installer et de proposer quelque chose au lecteur de surprenant. C'est toujours comme ça que vous travaillez?
I think so. I think... Yeah, I don't want my readers to be able to predict what's coming. And I treated the 10-book series, each novel, as pretty much a standalone novel, delivering what I call convergence. All your plot lines converge towards the end of the book. And I did want to make sure that I was going to catch the reader by surprise. So not just in events that occur, but in who survives and who doesn't survive. So I know in the French editions now, we are just finished at Deadhouse Gates, the second book. So some of the big bombshells are coming in the third one, Memories of Ice, but also the end of Deadhouse Gates as well.
simplement sur ces livres des Malaséens, donc je me souviens d'une table ronde aux Imaginales où vous disiez que malgré ce million d'exemplaires vendus, parfois vous aviez du mal à avoir d'autres contacts avec la littérature générale au Canada. C'est toujours le cas malgré ce succès, comme c'était de la fantasy.
Oh yeah. Canlit, that's what we call it, Canadian literature, is fairly, I'm going to use the phrase, it's stuck up. And fantasy and science fiction are pushed off to the side. They're not taken seriously. And that continues. I mean, I live in Victoria. There's a Victoria Writers, International Writers Festival every year. And I've never had an invite. I've never had an invite to any of these writers festivals. And that's pretty typical for Canada. I'm kind of used to being completely anonymous when I'm there.
Quelle relation vous avez justement avec ce million d'exemplaires vendus, ces traductions et puis tous ces lecteurs? J'ai même vu qu'il y avait un groupe de black metal avec un nom de vos personnages dedans. Comment est-ce que vous vivez ça en fait, tous ces gens qui ont lu et qui s'approprient un peu votre univers?
It's amazing. Yes, I know there's at least two metal or metal trash bands that are based on the books. And they've done songs also based on various storylines. I know of at least four children who are named after characters in the book, in the series. I've seen some amazing tattoos, pictures sent to me of various aspects of the series, including quotes, like long quotes, just tattooed. It is, I don't mind it. I think it's very flattering. And I know that some writers will take exception to sort of the fan-generated stuff. I don't really have a problem with it. I think it's really cool.
Et est-ce que c'est une pression dans l'écriture après? Quand on sait qu'il y a de l'attente un petit peu comme ça?
I don't think anyone else's pressure could match my own. So, I mean, I have to put that pressure on myself as a writer. So, no, I don't mind that expectation. I feel bad when it's taking me 2-3 years to finish a book, because I know fantasy readers, especially epic fantasy, have been pretty badly burned of late. They invest themselves into a writer's series, and then the writer is not completing that series. And I have a lot of sympathy for that. So when I'm sort of taking longer than normal, I do feel bad for the readers.
Quel type d'écrivain vous êtes? On dit souvent qu'il y a les scripturants et les structurants, des gens qui structurent bien leur histoire, qui se documentent avant de se mettre à écrire, et puis des auteurs qui, au contraire, vivent un petit peu au fil de la plume et inventent leur histoire quasiment en l'écrivant. Vous êtes comment? Vous documentez, vous préparez?
No, I don't prepare a lot. I guess I'm a bit of both. I have a loose structure, but I leave enough room for spontaneity. All the way through the storytelling. I don't have a word count per day, but I'll put in 2.5 to 3 hours a day. And sometimes that kind of writing session will produce a paragraph. Other times it produces 10 pages. And I don't really care what the word count is. As long as you are disciplined enough to work every day, or if you've got another job, to set aside time and be there at the keyboard for an allotted period of time. Whether you get one line written or a paragraph or a chapter actually doesn't matter. You're putting in the time is what counts. So in that sense, I'm fairly open and ready to follow characters and where they're going to go in the story. But once I start, I make sure that I'm doing this on a daily basis. You need that discipline. Because too easily you can be distracted by other things.
Et la relation, par exemple, justement au public, j'y reviens un petit peu, mais dans des salons, dans des conférences, dans des dédicaces, est-ce qu'elle vous influence, elle vous nourrit peut-être, ou comment est-ce que vous la vivez?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, writing's an isolating activity. It's a thing we do on our own. So to get out into the public and to meet the readers is brilliant. I love it. I've only recently started up a Facebook page, Steven Erickson Official, I think it's called, and I'm engaging with the fans through that as well. And only occasionally do I kick a hornet's nest, which I did quite recently by posting a meme on veganism and plastic fur, something along those lines. You know, it's curious. Generally, if I post something that has a political bent to it, you know, you get fairly extreme political views appearing on the site and commentary. That is nothing compared to veganism, right? I mean, this was serious stuff. So I had to sort of back off a little bit on that one. But it's good. It's great to be in engaged with the fans. And this is something new. It's something us writers have to sort of come to grips with. Because historically, that was not the case. Historically, the writer could remain remote and not necessarily a personality in and of themselves. And they weren't marketing that personality. They were simply marketing their books. Times have changed. Yeah.
Un petit mot, on vous connaît donc pour ce cycle des Malazéens, mais il y a pas mal de séries et de romans qu'on ne connaît pas du tout en France. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous en dire un petit mot? Je pense notamment à la trilogie, il y a deux tomes, hein. Carcanas Trilogie, par exemple. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous dire ce que c'est, par exemple?
Well, that's the one I mentioned earlier. That's the one that followed on from the Malazan series. So it is a very different writing style. It's a writing style that's based on breath length. Does that sound right? Breath length? Yeah. So the cadence of the spoken word and the spoken lines. They're novels that you could read out loud quite easily because I'm trying to evoke the oral tradition. That if I'm going back 200,000 years, I want to make a clean break from the style I was using for the 10-book series. The other trilogy that's in the States is The Willful Child. Those are satires loosely inspired by Star Trek, the original series. I asked myself, what would a starship captain be like if his only role model was James T. Kirk? And I just took it from there.
Et j'ai noté aussi Rejoice, A Knight of the Heart, en 2018.
Sorry? Rejoice, A Knight to the Heart? Yeah. Yeah, that one I spoke about a little bit yesterday. It's a first contact novel, and I guess it's my first serious foray into science fiction. And it's more of a thought experiment than anything else. And I find that most of my fiction is generated by something that has obsessed or haunted me for a long time. And so I was researching and reading First Contact novels, but researching ufology and pretty much all subjects related to that for at least 10, 12 years before I was ready to actually sit down and write a First Contact novel. And it poses a number of questions, and I just sort of leave it to the reader to decide how they want to actually interpret this novel, but it's come out in the UK, it's come out in North America, it will be coming out in French in April here. It's been picked up in Germany and Italy and Poland and Russia. And I think it's already being fairly controversial in the UK from what I've heard.
Beaucoup d'imaginaire dans tout ce qu'on a dit, beaucoup de fantasy, un peu de science-fiction. Est-ce que...
Yeah.
Oui.
Can you start that again?
Yes. Alors, beaucoup d'imaginaire dans ce que vous écrivez, beaucoup de fantaisie, un peu de science-fiction. Pour quelles raisons, en fait, utiliser ces genres de l'imaginaire pour vous en tant qu'écrivain? Vous avez fait aussi un petit peu de littérature générale.
I don't know why. what I've discovered is writing mimetic mainstream fiction, even the first Contact novel set here on Earth, you know, it's kind of an alternate Earth, was far easier to write than fantasy. Fantasy is a very difficult genre, probably the hardest genre to work in. And so coming back to it after all these years was quite liberating. It was quite relaxing to write. So I feel myself pulled in that direction. So I'm having to fight that because I've got the fantasy novels to write as well.
et pas du tout de polar ou d'autres genres?
Pas du Sorry, he's cutting out before.
Ouais, pas du tout de polar ou d'autres genres?
No, I did make a joke. I was going to be writing a British-style mystery with an inspector who McDonough, but I'm not going to. That's an English pun, so... Hugh McDonough, yeah.
Okay. Et comment est-ce que vous nourrissez votre imaginaire d'écrivain, pour le coup?
I didn't get that. Oops. Yeah, I can hear you now.
I can hear you now.
Okay. Comment vous nourrissez votre imaginaire d'écrivain?
How do I feel about it?
Ouais, comment est-ce que vous regardez des films,
right.
des séries, des documentaires, vous lisez d'autres auteurs peut-être?
Yeah, all of the above. Also, I still keep my hand in archaeology. And one of the advantages of archaeology is that you can travel to a place and immerse yourself in that place for some time. You have a reason to be there rather than just a tourist. And so when I work on sites, I try to sort of imagine... Well, one of the jobs you do as an archaeologist is you are using your imagination to actually peel back the landscape through time. And by doing that, you're rebuilding worlds that are not visible to us right now. And then you test your hypothesis by sticking a shovel in the ground. But I am always inspired when I'm on a site where I know we're looking at thousands, if not tens of thousands of years of history underfoot. That is really quite amazing. I've been working on a volunteer project in southern Italy for the last few years in Puglia. And the primary part of the site are a series of limestone caves, karst caves, that were at one time rebuilt into Byzantine churches. And so you walk into the cave and it's basically a church. You've got an altar and you've got paintings on the walls. And we're restoring some of these paintings. But you walk out from the cave and you look across to a plowed field. And that plowed field was originally a Neolithic village and then a Greek colony. Mm. So you can walk that field and you can pick up Greek pottery all over the place. And then just off to one side of all that, last time we were there, we hit three burials, very shallow burials. So all of this is sitting there and you don't know it unless you actually walk it and explore it. And that's what gets my imagination up and running.
Et une petite, on a beaucoup parlé d'univers hein, dans ce dialogue, mais on n'a pas beaucoup parlé de personnages. Quelle est votre relation à vos personnages? J'ai des auteurs qui, de temps en temps, me disent que c'est quasiment comme des amis, ils ont une vie propre, une logique propre. Est-ce que c'est la même chose pour vous?
Yes. I early on in my my writing education at the University of Victoria, I had a very good mentor, a Canadian author named Jack Hodgins, who directed me towards an American writer who writes about writing, or who did, named John Gardner. And he had an approach to fiction that emphasized what he called moral fiction, which means the author has a moral responsibility to their characters. And by extension, there is a moral responsibility to the reader. He was not, he had a rival who said the opposite, a man named William Gass, who basically said, in fiction, anything goes. Now that sounds great in theory, but in reality, that doesn't seem to be the case. As readers, William Gass would say, I could write this rape scene, for example, but nobody got raped. Therefore, I'm justified in writing it. John Gardner would say, well, actually, you're not quite justified in writing that. It depends on how you write it. And even though these are fictional characters, and so nobody has actually physically been raped, there is an emotional impact or resonance from that scene that's going to hit the reader in some fashion or another. So you need to be responsible for that. And I'm on that side of the thinking. I don't buy the William Gass thing. So my approach to all of my characters is, as despicable as some of them may be, I need to at least understand them. And then I need to place them in a context where the reader can at least to some extent, pick up the thematic importance of that role of that character within the story.
Et c'est facile de tuer un personnage?
Sometimes. Sometimes. It's easier to kill, obviously, a despicable character than it is a beloved character. But sometimes the story simply demands that that beloved character has to die. I've often argued, outraging many, many fans, that Frodo had to die in the third book of Lord of the Rings. Because of the grief that his friends were feeling, it becomes a false grief because he survives. Whereas the sacrifice he would have made having died is a much more profound one, at least to me. But I think Tolkien's love for his character overwhelmed the fictional demands of the narrative. And that's fine, that can happen.
Ça veut dire que parfois vos personnages ou vos histoires vous imposent leur propre logique par rapport à vos souhaits, vous d'écrivain.
Ouais. Yeah. The other thing is, I learned early on that fiction, as a writer, I approach fiction as a means of testing my worldview assumptions. And so I will create characters who have the opposite worldview to what I have. And then I'll let the story basically dismantle my own self-belief systems. And what I found was with short stories early on was that that dismantling would just leave me absolutely crushed. It removed my certainty about the world. And now, many, many years later, I'm actually very comfortable with being uncertain about the world. And certainty actually frightens me more than anything else, because that's where fanaticism comes from. And that's where political extremes will arise. I'd rather be uncertain.
On voit une carte là, la carte centrale.
Oh, right. Look, ouais. A map.
Une jolie carte. Quelle importance ça a pour vous, ça, en tant qu'auteur, d'avoir une carte? Est-ce que c'est une référence ou est-ce que ça vient vraiment après?
No, it comes first.
Yeah.
It comes first. Because we were approaching this as archaeologists, we read landscapes. And so you draw the map and you build your landscape, and that landscape is going to actually dictate a lot of aspects of the cultures within that landscape. Mm. And so it's a driving force to creating your story. And so I always started with maps, always.
On arrive, on a bien entamé notre heure. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question dans la salle avant que je termine les dernières questions sur le jeu de rôle ou sur sur le cycle des Malazéens, si vous l'avez tous lu? Une fois, deux fois, trois fois. Bon. Julien, tu n'as pas le droit de poser de questions. Peut-être qu'on vous voit beaucoup en France, vous avez vu aux Imaginales, il y a toute une tournée. Quelle relation vous avez un petit peu avec notre hexagone?
I adore France. I really do. It's hard to explain, but there's a whole aspect of Europe that I find extremely attractive. There seems to be a kind of cultural depth. You know, you're in Canada, and as an archaeologist, if I scrape through the first top 6 inches of soil, I've left human history behind. Right here, that history is just, and it is of great depth. And I think that actually it supports the culture in a different way. But I do have a great time when I'm here. And I'm going to be touring, I'm going to see most of France in the next month. So I'll be here until November 25th on a tour. And I'm looking forward to it.
Et maintenant, sur quoi est-ce que vous bossez là actuellement? Sur quoi est-ce que vous travaillez?
I'd like to say I'm working on learning French, but I'm so bad at languages that that's not likely. I am working on the new Carso Orlong trilogy. Carso Orlong's a character from the 10-book series. And I'm picking up his story 10 years after the 10-book series.
D'accord. Et dernier mot, quand vous voyez tous vos livres là, les uns avec les autres, physiquement parlant, qu'ils existent, maintenant que ça fait 15 ans, 20 ans que vous publiez, quel est votre regard sur ces années qui viennent de se passer, sur ces livres qui existent?
In a blur. And the weird thing is, because I've returned to the Malaysian world for this new trilogy, I've had to go back and reread stuff. And I normally don't reread my stuff at all. And it's always a shock. I think I was a better writer then than I am now. I'm convinced of that, actually.
Yeah. Ouais, et quand vous voyez toutes les couvertures, là, il y a un sentiment d'achevé ou d'inachevé parce qu'il faut encore écrire. Hein.
No, that series feels complete. I set out to do something in fantasy, and I think that encapsulates what I set out to do. For good or ill, I did the best I could. And so I'm very satisfied with the 10-book series. It is a bit frustrating because publishers from all over the world send me 10 copies of each of the books, so I'm slowly filling up my house with my own stuff. Great insulation, but apart from that, there are too many of them in many respects.
Y a-t-il une petite question? Oui. Allez-y, on va vous apporter le micro.
Bonjour. Merci Bonjour. Pour votre enthousiasme. Je pense qu'on peut dire que les littératures de l'imaginaire ont du succès. Et je voulais savoir quelle était votre idée sur ce que le lecteur contemporain venait chercher dans ce genre de littérature. Merci.
That's a very good question. There's been a stream of, I'm sure you'll know, might be familiar with the phrase grimdark. Right. Well, there's been a stream of that. It's not a new thing, but it's being recognized as a new thing by new readers. Grimdark's been around since Robert E. Howard. But this new strain of it is not something that I'm on board with. I find it too nihilistic. I find it too almost indulging in terms of its approach to violence. And I think it may be on its way out. I think readers, given the extremes of reality, that which surrounds us right now, politically and economically, I think fantasy is going to start re-offering a sense of optimism and hope. And I'm hoping that's what happens. Because that kind of nihilistic approach is it's kind of the voice of despair. And I'm hoping we can push past that at some point.
Est-ce que quelqu'un a une autre question? Oui, monsieur devant.
Hello, sorry I'm not familiar with your world. Thank you for sharing your experience. I have a technical question. You say your magic is not... a replacement for advanced technology. It stays mysterious. Does your magical magic produce unpredictable results?
No. No. We actually have a fairly clear sense of what the magic can do. But in the writing of it, we simply describe the effects. And we're consistent with that. So yes, when I say that an author who then explains all of their magic. I mean, they're explaining it on the page. The author always has to have a sense of what that magic is capable of doing, but you don't necessarily have to explain it to the reader. Okay, you see the difference? Yeah.
Yeah. It could be a narrative motor, not to know what magic could produce exactly. A magician being overwhelmed by its power, or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Y a-t-il une autre question? 1, 2, 3. Non. Bon, eh ben écoutez, c'est parfait. On va aller libérer Steven Erickson. Vous allez le retrouver tout de suite en dédicace et surtout, on va le remercier. On remercie les traducteurs. Merci à vous.
Thank you. Thank you.